Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me in back? My name is Ugetsu, and tonight I couldn't help but be influenced by this incredible little warm burst of spring that we're having. And spring has always been one of my favorite seasons because I love the energy of it. I love the new growth it brings. And it's always amazing to find those little pale green shoots buried beneath the leaves and the detritus of winter. And this new spurt of energy that calls out for action and a need to clear a path. Sometimes we call it spring cleaning. But it usually, to me, it indicates a new beginning. And for those of us who may work in academia, spring is a time of commencement. It's the time when our students graduate. At LIU, where I teach, the commencement ceremony happens on this great lawn. They put up this vast tent, and all of the students gather with their professors and the administration and their family and their friends. Everybody gathers in this space where usually students are just lounging around, sunning themselves, playing frisbee. But the spot becomes very auspicious on commencement day. And we all try and give some words of encouragement and send these new shoots out to make their way in the world. I've been thinking a lot about lawns lately and grass. During our Ango period that ended in March, we were studying a wonderful book, and I'm pretty sure it's still back there in the store. It's called The Hidden Lamp, and it's a wonderful collection of stories from 25 years of awakened women. And I'm not done with it. Ango is over, but I'm still not done with the book. It's really quite wonderful. One of the stories that has been particularly helpful in my practice is Ling Zhao's Shining Grasses. And it's accompanied by a very insightful commentary by Jisho Warner. So Ling Zhao was the revered daughter of layman and laywoman Pang. The Pang family are very highly revered figures in Zen. They're enlightened but completely iconoclastic. They will never, in their time, numerous times they were offered to ordain. They were offered all kinds of positions, and they always maintain their position outside the monastery as lay people. When earlier on in their family life, Layman Pang had been a pretty wealthy merchant, and the family therefore had a little bit of time so they could study the sutras and they could travel and meet with the highly regarded teachers of the day. But at a certain point in their lives, they decided to cut off attachments, and they took all of their possessions and they sunk them in the lake. And after that point, Pang, his wife, daughter, and son made their living by crafting bamboo cooking utensils. And Ling Zhao was particularly renowned for the baskets that she wove out of the long grasses. She's also known, the daughter is also known, as someone who has an especially penetrating understanding of the Dharma. And many times in stories, she's the one who comes in at the end with the gotcha moment. And she does in this story. In the story of the Shining Grasses, layman Pang is sitting in his thatched cottage, and he's busy studying the sutras, and he's muttering to himself, difficult, difficult, difficult. It's like trying to store 10 bushels of sesame seeds in the top of a tree. And if you can imagine that, you know, trying to put all of these tiny little seeds up atop a tree and they're just kind of raining down in the wind. His wife is over his shoulder there and says, easy, easy, easy. It's like touching your feet to the floor when you get out of bed. Just that moment, you never think about it. Just you put your foot on the floor and you make your way. And so little Ling Zhao pipes up and says, neither difficult nor easy. It's like the teachings of the ancestors shining on the 100 grass tips. I love that imagery. I love the imagery of her answer. And it resonated with me back in March, because back then life for me felt difficult, difficult, difficult. I was in the middle of a semester that wasn't going very well. All the goals I had in my classes seemed to be, I kept on having to push the goalpost further along. Things weren't happening in the way I'm accustomed to. And I had the feeling like I was trying to cook with glue on the floor, you know, just kind of impeded. And which is another way of saying it's trying to store a bushel of sesame seeds up on top of a tree. I totally empathize with Layman Pang at that moment. But I also identify, and many times I've been laywoman Pang too. Many times things have felt like they were going so smoothly, so beautiful. How beautiful the moon was on Saturday night. If you looked up and saw it, it was just beautiful. And there, at that moment when I saw it, there was nothing separate. Everything was there. But we could get spoiled by that lull, or we could try and cling to it and try and remain in that nostalgic moment for when the moon and everything was perfect. And there's a danger in that too. And that's why Ling Zhao comes up with such a brilliant reframing of the exchange. It's neither difficult or easy. So she's immediately breaking down this binary opposition. And that's important in the story, because oftentimes our minds are drawn to binaries. It's kind of one of the ways that we reason and learn. So oftentimes you may find yourself, or I find myself, caught in these binaries that really only make sense in a corner of my mind, but they're not helpful. What she says, when she unexpectedly reframes the whole conversation, it's like the teachings of the ancestors shining on the 100 grass tips. So what's she trying to focus our attention to here? Last weekend, my partner Lori and I were driving back to New York City around sunset. And I never like coming home on Sundays, because you're always bucking traffic, and I don't like being caught in traffic. I have kind of an aversion for it. But as we drove past the swamps of Secaucus on the way to the Lincoln Tunnel, there were these beautiful fields of waving grasses. They're amazing. You know, you're going past this kind of industrial area, and then you see just these long waving grasses that kind of form this moving sculpture along the highway. And I was really struck by them. And in that moment, my anxiety, the unpleasantness of being in the car in traffic kind of dropped. And for a time, all that mattered was that teaching for me. And it was one of those moments when you can see the flower that's offered and smile. I'm also thinking about grasses a lot these days because spring is a renewed time of commitment to my lawn. And I never thought I would speak about commitment to a lawn because I grew up in a kind of awful relationship to lawn care, but I'll get to that in a minute. About 10 years ago, the reason I have a lawn, I live in Manhattan, but I have a lawn because my partner, Lori and I, bought this neglected house about an hour outside the city about 10 years ago. And the fantasy was at the time that this would be our getaway, that every weekend we would go, get out of the traffic and the noise and just enjoy nature. And it really was a fantasy because it was a gulag, it was a work camp. Every weekend we went up to this house and ended up having to do enormous amounts of work because the place was very neglected. So I remember the first time I saw a photo of the house that we would buy, and it was the realtor had photographed it in a very creative way. It was covered all in autumn leaves, and it had just the slogan, "Autumn Charm." And it was remarkably, remarkably affordable, and so we thought, oh, let's jump on it. But it was affordable because it was falling down, and the lawn hadn't been mowed in over a year. So what those leaves were hiding was just a complete thatched mess, about 2 acres of thatched mess of grass and weeds. And, you know, I took it as my task to sort of get some order, but it was a challenge for me because I grew up with a father who was maniacal about his lawn. Every week he carefully mowed this, and we lived in Queens, so if you've ever seen a Queens lawn, they're tiny. It's about the size of, just a little patch of grass. But every week he would mow it and manicure it, and that was the absolute only time that anyone was allowed on the lawn. And I really, I pitied any kid on the block who had the misfortune of having their ball go on my father's lawn, because what you would observe is they would scurry out like a jackrabbit to get that ball and to get the hell out of there before my father swung open the front door and said, "Get off of my lawn!" So it wasn't actually, you know, pleasant growing up with this kind of energy invested in the lawn. And my mother recently said to me, you know, I never could find you when you were a kid. And I said, because I was over at my friend's house where we could sit on the lawn and we could roll in it and play with it and make little whistles out of a blade of grass that you blow through. Some of my fondest memories are, you know, laying in a patch of grass on a sunny day with my friends. But that all withered when I looked at 2 acres of weeds and thatch grass. So my father, who was alive at the time, came up and assessed the situation. And I think he understood my dilemma, because for my 50th birthday, he bought me a lawn tractor. That was my gift for my 50th birthday from him. And it was a passing of the torch in a big way. And so over the years, I've tended the grass on top of my lawnmower, and during this time, I've learned a lot about lawns. And I've become more aware of my relationship with the grasses and what it means to be engaged in this act of husbandry, making something grow. I thought that the term, when I looked it up, I thought it was related to, you know, husband, like husband, wife, but the old English was housebound. And that kind of makes sense too, because if you're tending any kind of crop, you're kind of housebound. You can't leave for long periods of time because your attention is needed at home. You are housebound. And I saw this. My grandfather back in Italy was a peasant farmer. And what I observed is that this man would never sit down to eat, no matter how hot or how tired he was. He would never sit down to eat before the animals were watered and fed. And that was just part of the bargain. The animals eat, and then you eat, then you end your day, or you take your break. But I can tell you that I saw similar dynamics of the cultivation of the grass as well. Because in order to have what we can consider a lawn, that is a thick carpet of grass, you have to mow it. Not mowing it causes the grass to get long, to fall over, it gets thatched, and the water doesn't reach the roots. When you mow it, as long as you don't take too much off, the roots spread out and the grass spreads out and fills in the gaps, and it becomes that thick carpet that we associate with sod. On the other hand, if you mow too much, then what happens is if you scalp the lawn, you make it stressed out, and then the lawn becomes very vulnerable to drought or insects, or even weeds. So there's an art in getting it just the right height. I found out a little while back that if you use a mulching blade on the mower, you're actually cutting up the clippings, they go back into the lawn, and you never have to use any fertilizers or harmful chemicals that leach into the water system. And I found that another unifying aspect of this relationship with the grass was the total absorption I had to bring to mowing it. Because although I've observed and learned a lot from doing it over the years, I can't rely on that knowledge because it's constantly changing. When you're on a lawn tractor and you're mowing the grass, you always have to be aware, because there could be a rock or a critter could run out in front of you. This is hilly terrain, so if you go up a hill at the wrong angle, you could tip the whole lawnmower and it could fall on you. I know someone is actually injured pretty badly when the lawnmower fell on his legs. So, you know, you have to pay attention and be mindful when cultivating the grass. And I can say that I didn't expect, when I first started out to write this, to say so much about lawn care in a Dharma talk. But I was surprised and somehow redeemed when I went back and looked at the teachings and found there's actually a lot of teachings that have to deal with grass. One of the oldest goes all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. It's case 4 from the Book of Serenity. And this has Shakyamuni one day is out walking in the field with his followers, and the Indian deity Indra was tagging along. And so Buddha suddenly stopped, looked at the ground and pointed and said, "This spot would be good to build a temple." And without missing a beat, Indra plucks out a blade of grass and sticks it in the ground exactly where Buddha had pointed to. He said, "The temple is built." And the Buddha smiled. So, in thinking about the story, the koan, What makes this act of sticking the blade of grass in the ground a temple? It's not Buddha's presence, really. Or it's not that Indra chose that particular blade of grass. Rather, it's in that moment that Indra, in the totality of that moment, Indra understood that nothing was lacking. This spot's good to build a temple. In the case of our daily lives, this spot could be a deep stretch that we give ourselves, or giving your attention completely to a friend who needs to confide in you. That also is a moment of presence and sanctity, and a moment that in itself is its temple. When we wake up and avail ourselves to the great reality, you realize that each thing, every being, is a temple or a Buddha. And to recognize the truth of each moment is to plant that blade of grass over and over and over again. But when we separate from the great field, we're like Layman Peng muttering, difficult, difficult, difficult. He's so busy because he's separated. He's in the sutras, and he's separated from everything that's sacred. How ironic. You know, it's almost like expecting Manjushri there to come down and to cut away my delusions. I don't need that. I have a pain in my hip right now that is taking away all my delusions. You know, Manjushri's manifesting everywhere. You just have to pay attention. I think all of us long for this kind of connection. And yet, you know, the irony is it's not absent. It's like waiting for the bus to take you home in front of your house. You know, you just go inside. But there are also the pitfalls of clinging to these idealized notions of perfect reality. And here it can be tricky, because for laywoman Pang, you know, that ease of placing your foot on the ground in the morning is wonderful. But we practice because what happens when your arthritis flares up and that moment isn't pleasant? That moment is painful, and it's going to take you 5 minutes to feel your legs under you properly before you can move on and go on with your day. These are the moments when it's so important to break down. Easy, difficult, easy, difficult. It's an equation of suffering at that point, because sometimes things are difficult. They just are what they are. When you're really practicing, you see within this moment your true self, the connection to something greater than that binary. That is a path to something bigger. So, you know, I'm crazy about Layman Peng. I've been investigating him and his family. They're a wonderful example of these iconoclasts who, you know, very idiosyncratic people who manage to follow the teachings and embody them. And in that act, they always seem to be pointing to the sacred in the everyday. So I'll leave you with probably one of my favorites and one that he's known most for. One day, the very venerable Zen master Shito asked Layman Pang, "What have your daily activities been?" And he offered, Layman Pang offered this verse. My daily activities are not unusual. I'm just naturally in harmony with them. Grasping nothing, discarding nothing. In every place, there's no hindrance, no conflict. My supernatural power and marvelous activity, drawing water and chopping firewood. And there it all is, drawing water, chopping firewood, making your breakfast, throwing out the coffee grinds, whatever it is, these are your supernatural activities. When you recognize who you are and this great gift of being here. This is a temple. Down the hallway is the bathroom. It is not a dirty place. It is a temple of its own. The temple is not locked in these walls. It's in the sounds of the street that have been cascading in these windows throughout this talk. It's everywhere that you care to cultivate. So on your way home tonight, I wish you all supernatural and marvelous activities as you prepare for your evening.